Her recently released album, Manawawera. I was caregiver. No, I've spent the last 20 weeks, says a texter, at home after leaving work to take care of mental health. And now at a point of making more connections with my community, a global community begins to meet me in retreat. Companionship and challenge has been on the programme this morning, and I will watch, cheer, and I will read of the Scottish mountains. That's good. As a gay man, and this is in relation to the interview with Ariel just before, as a gay man, I never needed a refuge. I find lovely people whom I like and like me. Would one ask, have the All Blacks found their refuge? Well, were you, as a matter of interest, brought up in small town Texas? Just wondering. It's 17 minutes to 11. Scientists from all over the world are sharing and comparing genetic information about SARS-CoV-2 and indeed other viruses and tracking their mutation and spread as never before. They're using a platform called Next Strain, and one of them is a New Zealander, phylogeneticist Dr. James Hadfield, who's based in Wanaka and he works for Bedford Lab in Seattle. And he's with us on Skype to explain what it is he is doing. Interesting times for you, James.
Yes, it's a little bit all-encompassing, isn't it, Kim?
How's Wanaka? Quiet at the moment?
It's quiet, yes. It doesn't, I don't think reality's set in yet, quite yet.
No. Well, quiet might mean that reality has set in, of course. What are you doing? Like, what are you going to be doing today?
So what we're doing is sort of sitting on the shoulders or standing on the shoulders of all of these amazing scientists around the world who are contributing sequences of the virus that they're sampling in different countries around the world. And what we're doing is sort of combining all of that data together to draw a family tree, which helps us understand certain characteristics of the viral movement around the world. And then we have a very, very strong focus on open science and open data. So we do a lot of work to then turn around and share our findings as quickly as possible with the wider community.
So how many genomes have you got now?
So as of last night, and we might have a few more now, but we had 720-odd last night, which are sequenced from over 35 different countries, including us here in New Zealand.
And how different are they all from one another?
Yeah, so I think Chris talked this morning and used a really nice analogy about sort of a classroom where the teacher writes a phrase on the whiteboard and the students copy it down. And of course, every now and again, there's going to be some errors, which we are completely expected. And so our data expect that coronavirus is going to mutate at, very roughly speaking, back of the envelope, around about 24 mutations in a given year. So the highest number we have so far is about 10 to 12. From the original outbreak in Wuhan a few months ago.
How do you know?
So, as you can imagine, going back to this nice analogy that Chris used, as these children make copies from the blackboard, let's sort of extend the analogy that these children then take that copy and go somewhere else, and other children copy off that copy, and so on and so forth. So over time, these copies are going to become more diverged from the original blackboard version. And by sequencing all of these different copies or these copies at different generations from around the world and comparing them, we can find, through modeling, we can work out how different all of these copies are. And then we can start to go back in time and say, well, what was the most likely version that existed on the blackboard or that existed in those first generation of copies, even though we may never have or we will not ever know those, be able to sample those exact genomes.
Blimey, it's like going back to the Big Bang but not quite getting exactly there. You're always just a few minutes away from it.
Yes, and with all of these things, you know, there's always uncertainty. So we don't pretend to be able to ever know exactly what was on the blackboard or exactly when it happened, but we can start to put estimates around dating those events and events have spread into different countries.
So you've got about 700-odd genomes, but there have been, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of cases now. Does every single one of your genomes differ slightly from the other at the moment?
No, it doesn't. In fact, a lot of them group identically. And so that has pros and cons. So it does make it harder to follow transmission. So what it looks like at the moment, especially in Europe, is there's the potential for quite a lot of transmission between countries. But because those genomes are identical, it's very hard to reconstruct exactly the transmission routes. So we estimate that around about every second or third transmission between people, we're going to detect, or there's going to be a mutation that we can then detect. But then the flip side of that is that in this outbreak, compared to all of the others, we've seen a really amazing willingness to share data from the international community. And part of that, I think, could be related to the fact that because a mutation only arises every second or third transmission, we cannot say definitively that this one individual infected this other individual. So I think that's giving people more confidence to share data more widely.
How do you mean giving people more confidence?
In the sense that it's less identifiable to...
I see.
We can identify the broad scale movements across the world and between some countries.
Right.
But we're not going to have the resolution to be able to say this exact person gave it to this person on this date.
So what you've got is essentially a one-stop shop of the pathogen's genome data on Next Strain.
Yes, so all of the data is being publicly shared with the world, not just us, but then we turn around and we've developed over the last few years a lot of scientific tools needed that are needed to carry out the analysis and turn those sequence data into, say, a family tree in a time frame that's quick enough that we can use the results to inform potential policy or inform people of what's happening right now.
Is that what a phylogeneticist does, James?
Exactly, yes. So we use, in former times, it was just a single gene in the virus or in the organism, and now it's becoming the whole genome, so all of the 30,000 letters of the coronavirus, and then essentially making or working out the evolutionary relationships between those samples, drawing a family tree, and then answering, that allows us to answer a number of questions about the movement and the origins and the timings.
And what answers have you found so far, do you think?
So in lots of these zoonotic type pathogens, so that means pathogens that exist in an animal reservoir and then jump into humans. A really big question is this jump happen? Did this jump happen one time? Or is this a continual jump that's a continual spillover from the animal reservoir? Because that has drastic implications for how we try and control the outbreak. And in this case, it's been able to say very conclusively that it was almost certainly a single introduction to humans centred in and around Wuhan a few months ago now.
And you know that because?
Because the diversity that we are seeing of all 700 samples collected around the world point clearly to having one single common origin in a human, or in that jump from an animal to a human.
Do you mean the lack of diversity is pointing to that?
Exactly, the lack of diversity.
And does that help our handling of it?
Yes, I think Broadly speaking, were this to be continual spillover from an animal reservoir, our response would be very, very different. And these
Yeah.
questions are quite important. And the often when we have good stories about this, where we solve it, we don't necessarily hear those results so much. So a few years ago, Lassa fever, which is a hemorrhagic fever similar to Ebola, cases started to spike in Nigeria, and the fear was that, hey, this is an outbreak. It's a single jump into humans, and we've got a big problem here. And genomic sequencing was able to very, very quickly, and genomic sequencing, I should say, done by scientists in Nigeria, was able to very, very quickly identify that no, actually, these are just multiple events coming from the animal reservoir. So it's we don't have ongoing human-to-human transmission. We've got a problem with the animal reservoir. And so the response in that case was very different.
If you can establish that it was a single zoonosis from a bat, can you also establish what the intermediary was between bat and human?
Yes, so that is the big question. So we don't actually know that it was a zoonosis from a bat. So what we do know is that the most closely related genome that we have got out there, bearing in mind that there is a lot of coronavirus in bats and other animals that we don't know about simply because we don't test and we don't sample. So what we can say is that the closest relative, if you will, to COVID-19 did exist in a bat, but it's close. By close, I mean that it's diverged by maybe 50, maybe 100 years ago. And what's very intriguing is that there's a very small region of the genome which is actually much closer to a sample collected from a pangolin. So the closest relative across the whole genome isn't in a pangolin, but in this one part of the genome that turns out to be very important for binding to cells in humans, it's closest to a pangolin. So that's why we believe that it may have jumped from a bat into a pangolin and then into humans. But that's quite speculative at this stage.
And can you also track how where it went from China?
Yes, we can. Again, with uncertainty at almost every stage. And that's what we present through NextStrain, which is a we use websites to disseminate a lot of this information intentionally for so that we get the broadest range of audience. And so it's used by scientists as well as public health, and we hope by just the general public. And there we do infer the movements out of China into other countries, and then as the disease takes hold in other countries, we can infer movements from those other countries to further countries and indeed back now back into China.
So the first known US case was in Washington State. Can you track it from China to Washington State?
So at that high level of resolution, we sort of think that it probably came directly from China, but we actually know that more from the epidemiology. So the first known case in Washington State had a travel history to Wuhan. So it's overwhelmingly likely that that was a direct transmission. But what becomes more interesting as we go on is that then that original case in Washington State in the first half of, or second half of January, by all accounts, did absolutely everything right. Self-isolated, we believed there was no onward transmission. But then about 6 weeks later, we sequenced a genome, the second genome in Washington State, and the genetic link was such that it was very likely that it was a descendant of that first case in Washington. So even though that first individual did everything right and we thought there was no onward transmission, the sequencing shows that there was, in fact, weeks and weeks of cryptic transmission or transmission that
Crikey.
wasn't observed. And now we have quite a sizable outbreak in Washington State, and the vast majority of it is all from that initial transmission chain.
So that's a bit depressing, really, because if they did everything right and you're still ending up with community transmission, It means that it's inevitable.
It's a worry, especially for a country like New Zealand, but that's where genome sequencing can really help, because one of the things that we can very quickly say, and I should say that with the work being done at ESR as well as plenty of other places around the world, we're starting to be able to get this genomic data in a matter of days, and in theory a matter of hours after the sample is collected or the sample turns positive. And what this information can tell us very quickly is whether or not it might be representative of community transmission, like in the Washington case we just discussed, or whether it looks like a new introduction from overseas. And that data can really help epidemiologists and the contact tracing and the response to the outbreak more generally.
And what about testing? Are you able to contribute to, you know, speedier testing, or for those who have had it, testing for antibodies?
No, so we're sort of coming downstream of the testing. So the general process and what we hope will happen in New Zealand is that any test that is positive, because testing itself is quicker and usually more sensitive than genome sequencing. So the general process is that once a test is positive, that same sample is then sequenced. And from the genome we get from that sequence, we can infer information about its spread and where it may come from that could be helpful for the response.
So there are epidemiologists and there are molecular epidemiologists, and you're molecular epidemiologists.
Yes, more on that second half of things. Yeah. And so it's important to say that none of this work is out there to replace epidemiology. Epidemiology is absolutely crucial. Our work here is to
complement
help
it.
Them.
Yeah.
Complement them, exactly.
Yeah, yeah. And would it be helpful in the development of a vaccine?
So, very generally speaking, yes. And we do a lot of work on influenza virus that is useful for the influenza vaccine, which has to be sort of made every year. So we do believe and we hope that our data is useful to those making the vaccine. But vaccinology is a huge enterprise, which we are only very peripherally related to.
It's very good to talk to you, James. If you have a eureka moment, you just give us a call.
Will do. Nice to talk to you, Kim.
Thanks, James. Dr. James Hadfield, who is a phylogeneticist. He's working along with other scientists all around the world using a platform called NextStrain to put together all their knowledge about the genome of the SARS-CoV-2 to benefit the tracing and the tracking of it. Coming up after 11 o'clock.